Oh, hello again. Thanks for coming out on this dreary pre-winter Sunday. Now, I love being a Unitarian Universalist. I resonate with the idea of oneness, of inextricable interconnectedness. I revel in the thought of a loving, unfolding mystery that oftentimes I call God. Excuse me, that's my shorthand for that loving, unfolding mystery. Glenn Thomas Rideout, who is the music director at the Congregation of Ann Arbor, Michigan, tells us, God is no noun, and certainly not an adjective. God is at least a verb, and even that shrinks her. And then he goes on to say, we're getting Michelangelo all wrong. God is not the bearded one surrounded by angels floating over the Sistine. He is not Adam with his muscled back pressing the earth. No, God is the closing inch of space between their reaching fingers. Which reminds me of a bit of UU conversation, and UU, by UU, I mean Unitarian Universalist, overheard during the coffee hour. A woman said, I have no reason to believe in gods at all, and yet I can't quite consider myself an atheist, not yet. So she thought a moment, and she concluded, at present, I believe I have friends, imaginary friends in high places. My idea of God. Just to mention, I have the God poem and several of the readings here if you'd like a copy. And if they're gone, please talk with me and I can email them to you. But I love this faith. I love this living faith, this faith community, this life journey. It challenges me. It uplifts me. And sometimes it frustrates and dismays me. This faith community is not without its tensions. Its shadow side, if you'd like to say, its misrepresentations, its dangers. And today I'll talk about a little chapter in a book called The Unitarian Way. And I think David has referred to this book too. The Unitarian Way by Philip Hewitt is a very erudite, learned man who was the minister at the Vancouver Church since dirt was new. I mean, he was there for, like, I don't know, 25, 30, 35 years, came from England. He was there for a long, long time, and he's written several books. And he has this little chapter, 9 pages, in this book called The Unitarian Dance. And he does refer to us simply as Unitarians, which is more common in Canada. So he talks about the polarities we may experience in this non-creedal, non-dogmatic faith. Now, by creed, I mean some system of belief that's usually authoritative, that somebody says, this is what you're going to believe, and dogma is a particular teaching that is very authoritative, is something you should believe if you're going to stay in this faith. Well, we're non-creedal, non-dogmatic. Many of us actually are fleeing from the dogma of a previous religion, a religion that we grew up in, or some of us came from a background of really no religion at all. If we're fleeing from a religion based in dogma, or startled by the sometimes extreme outcomes of dogma, of being absolutely sure you are right, we're happy to find a faith without it. Now, if you've read a bit of Unitarian history, our tenets, our beliefs, are kind of grouped around the ideas of freedom, tolerance, and individuality. And Reverend Hewitt's Unitarian Dance looks at these beliefs at the extremes of these hallmarks of our progressive faith. So he goes through four of them, and they are quite interconnected. Don't be surprised if you're having trouble parsing them out. But the first set of tensions he sees is the tension between freedom and responsibility. Now, freedom allows us to forge our own way, that to be all we can be, to discover who we really are in this world, and this community honors that freedom. And we welcome you, whoever you are. We welcome you, wherever you come from. We welcome you, whomever you love. We welcome you. So freedom, we talked a lot about freedom in early writings. William Ellery Channing, who's an early 19th century minister, wrote a sermon called Spiritual Freedom. And parts of that sermon are contained in a reading in our hymnal, number 592, and it's called The Free Mind. It's a grand, glorious reading. And he says, I call that mind free which masters the senses and which recognizes its own reality and greatness, which passes life not in asking what it shall eat or drink, but in hungering, thirsting, and seeking after righteousness. It keeps going on, grand, glorious words, kind of the self-made man ideal. Which kind of reminds me of another story. A UU discussion group, someone commented that sometimes Unitarians lack humility. We really have found the way. Yeah, another member said, we have a problem thinking that we're better than everyone else. And a third member chimed in and said, you know, if only we could get rid of our arrogance, we'd be perfect. And we're still working on that. We are working on that. Now, I don't mean to denigrate Channing's writing. It's a wonderful, wonderful writing, especially if you've been in a group that restricts what you're able to think of and think about. But it's interesting that immediately after his writing in the hymnal, there is a writing by a quote from Bishop Desmond Tutu. And Bishop Tutu writes, liberation is costly. Freedom is costly. Even after the Lord had delivered the Israelites from Egypt, they had to travel through the desert. They had to bear the responsibilities and difficulties of freedom. And they had to band together, walk through the desert together to get to the promised land. Bishop Tutu reminds us that free thinking must be done in concert with others. Living out your freedom is done in community responsibly. You know, Ralph Waldo Emerson was a free thinker, a person living free out in the woods. You know, free-ish. You know, I think he still went to his mom's who did his laundry. But, you know, free. But we also have to remember that people like free thinkers, like the terrorist, the U.S. Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, was also a free thinker who thought he was free out in those woods. Your thinking needs to be done in community is Reverend Hewitt's argument. Now, a second tension he talks about is between our reason and our emotion, between our head and our heart. Now, in another small book called Elite, Uncovering Classism in Unitarian Universalist History by Mark Harris, Harris notes that the average schooling of a Unitarian is 16.7 years. That means that most of us have gone through part of a master's degree when it comes to education. Unitarians are, to a great extent, intellectuals. Philip Hewitt remarks, you don't have to be a PhD to be Unitarian, but it helps. Yeah, we're a profoundly intellectual bunch, and whether we have a high school education or not even that much, we are always thinking about things. Many proudly carry the title of humanist, rationalist. We question the superstitions of old. We question gods, spirits, soul, angels, devils, hell, religious ritual. We're doubters. We treasure our doubt. We think about all of those things. So, another story. When I first got to the Unitarian Fellowship in Missoula, Montana, that's kind of western Montana, the place was full of professors. And not just professors, I mean full professors. They were tenured. Boy, they knew their stuff. And they came on Sunday to hear a lecture, a learned talk. And I can remember at the beginning of one service, Sunday service, right before someone was going to light the chalice, there came a loud whisper from the back saying, "Do we really have to light that thing?" We can be great literalists. Later a doctor joined this very same group, and Todd always had some sort of concern about his teenage kids. They were a couple of rowdy kids. And he needed to talk about that and share that with the group during Candles of Joy and Sorrow, but he could never bring himself to light a candle. That was just too woo-woo for him. It was too superstitious. So another downside of just being too rational is that we can be a quite literal-minded crowd, not comfortable with symbolism or metaphor or ritual, the smells and bells of faith, the emotions that happen, hopefully, during a Sunday service like this. Now, our universalist side, which is more committed to Christianity, and the ethic of love, is more our spiritualist, mystic, emotive sort of group. Now that doesn't mean that rationalists or humanists can't express emotions, but we can have people on either side. The folks who enjoy ritual, who want whatever is spoken from the pulpit to be from the heart, who long for music that breaks us open, that makes us feel, that want to be swept away. I confess I am one of those. I had the reputation in seminary. If I wasn't crying at the end of our Wednesday evening Vespers service, it was just as dull as dishwater service. So I expect to be taught and moved. The downside of this romantic, heartfelt side is that we can become kind of untethered from reality. We can be hornswoggled or unmoored from reason. Our hearts can be so open that it seems like our brains are falling out. During the 19th century, universalists mostly started believing in a lot of scientific sorts of theories that proved to not be true at all. One was phrenology, the study of the shape and size of the cranium. They thought that would indicate character and intellect, the bumps and valleys in your head. And others were taken in by spiritualists, and by this I mean folks who said that they were channeling the spirits of the dead, and most of those people turned out to be quite fake. They were frauds. But to speak on their behalf, these universalists wanted to find the science behind the divine, to measure the soul, to find the reason behind dreams and feelings, wanted to somehow contain and measure the mystery. So we Unitarians and Universalists balance between a strict rationalism and a heartfelt romanticism. And certainly in recent years, our Sunday services have noticeably moved more from a lecture, question and answer period format to a more spirit-filled gathering. And you'll see that definitely in the larger churches. Been here too, I think, a little when I come here. We don't want calibrations on a certain topic. We want celebrations of life in all its aspects, its highs and its lows. But we're a little group, so we've got people on both ends and in the middle. So that's the second tension. the tension between the head and the heart. And the third tension Philip talks about is between tolerance and commitment. Tolerance of opposing ideas and commitment to an idea or an ideal, a conviction of our beliefs. In a positive sense, tolerance is opposed to bigotry and persecution. Others' differences are accepted or allowed, but tolerance can be neutral and sometimes even negative. Listen to the difference of, well, I tolerate that Wiccan group in church. I tolerate those trans people in church. That is very, very different than we celebrate. We celebrate the differences and the uniqueness of the New Moon group or of our LGBTQ questioning queer intersex asexual community. Tolerance can be a kind of a, oh, I'll tolerate that. You know, I tolerate weak coffee, but I certainly don't appreciate it. So, in 1934, National Conference for Christians and Jews, this is down in the States, and it's now called the National Conference for Community and Justice. Christians and Jews, community and justice, I like that. They started National Brotherhood Week. And the purpose of that was to bring diverse people together to address interfaith divisions. Now, it was celebrated on the third week in February down in the U.S., kind of died out about 50 years later in the 80s. But in the 60s and 70s, there was a mathematician and a satirist and songwriter who wrote a tribute, Tom Lear. Oh, the poor folks hate the rich folks, and the rich folks hate the poor folks. All of my folks hate all of your folks. It's American as apple pie. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, New Yorkers love the Puerto Ricans 'cause they're very chic. Oh, step up and shake the hand of someone you can't stand. You can tolerate him if you try. Now, Lear would preface this particular piece with these words, and he'd say, during National Brotherhood Week, various special events are arranged to drive home the message of brotherhood, and he said something else, and then he continued, this year, for example, and the year was 1965, on the first day of the week of National Brotherhood Week, Malcolm X was killed, which gives you an idea of how effective the whole thing is. I'm sure we all agree that we ought to love one another, and I know there are people out in the world that do not love their fellow human beings, and I hate people like that. Oh, the Protestants hate the Catholics, and the Catholics hate the Protestants, and the Hindus hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, it's national, everyone smile at one anotherhood week. Be nice to people who are inferior to you. It's only for a week, so have no fear. Be grateful that it doesn't last all year. Yeah. The Hindus hate the Muslims and everybody hates the Jews. Lots more people are worried about Muslims. These days, we hope as Unitarians, Universalists, to go beyond tolerance to a joyful, heartfelt, knowledgeable appreciation, a greater understanding of those unlike ourselves. And those of us who have been swimming in white for all of our lives, yeah, that takes some doing. It takes some doing. So one of our ministers commented, she said, it has been my observation that when there is only one Unitarian Universalist congregation in town, sooner or later everyone I don't like comes to that church and forces me to reflect on their inherent worth and dignity. No. Yeah, that's, yeah. I have been forced to, at other fellowships to reflect on people's inherent worth and dignity. So the unhelpful side of tolerance is a smugness about being on the right side of an issue, or a mind, sometimes a mind so open to every side of an issue that everything is judged to be okay. So another story. One year I took a couple of our teenage girls from our Missoula congregation down to a Unitarian youth conference down in Colorado. And once there, some adults and I were kind of listening in to this conversation by a group of girls. And one girl said, well, he did rape her, but that was his choice, so we have to accept it. Now, we did have a long talk after that. Too much tolerance can lead to a lack of commitment to any important idea, ideal, ethic. Those girls we overheard were young. They didn't understand the difference between the worth of an individual and the principled dismay and disturbance of that person's actions, unethical actions. So the worrisome side of tolerance, of commitment is an adamant commitment, a rigid, cold, insensitive commitment without any nuance. A more balanced view of tolerance and commitment is what the Reverend Raymond Holt calls an open-minded certainty, that we are committed to an idea or an ideal, but we are open to hearing those arguments against it. I talked a little bit about that in my newsletter article, and John Stuart Mill, his Marketplace of Ideas. Every idea should be talked about, but we need to talk through it and think about the results. Commitment to an ideal, an ethic, an idea, a principle that is respectful of the individual as well as the community. We cannot be absolutely certain we're right, we're absolutely 100% right, but we can be pretty darn sure and be willing to act from that open-minded certainty. So that's tolerance and commitment to an idea or an ideal. And the last tension that Philip talks about is between the individual and the community. Now, each of us is proud to be an individual. We are unique, one of a kind. That is all true. I have met a lot of really unique individuals at Unitarian Universalist congregations. But we are here together in community, oriented to a common task, to a shared mission and vision. You know, and we're an inclusive spiritual community that promotes a compassionate, just, sustainable world. That's what Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship is about. Now, individuality may become a rigid self-sufficiency that cannot ask for help, or that becomes narcissistic or self-centered or tyrannical, but so can a community become tyrannical. Think of The Handmaid's Tale. Those of you who have followed Margaret Atwood, read the book, or followed the series. A community can have a series of rules and traditions that squash any individuality. Hong Kong, Singapore. Life in a faith community must balance between the individual perspective with the need for a viable, vibrant, learning, and growing community. So we have those classes in compassionate communication, conflict resolution skills. I was recently at a minister's retreat where we talked about how conflict-averse Unitarian Universalist congregations may be, and how we all need, and especially those of us in the Midwest who are just, you know, Thunder Bay, Minnesota nice. So we do need to learn throughout our lives to strike a balance between the individual and the community. As Ashley Horan reminds us, our ancestors and our descendants are beckoning us, compelling us onward toward greater connection, greater compassion, greater commitment to one another and to the earth. Together we are resilient and resourceful. Resourceful enough to say yes to that call to make our life's work in a thousand different ways, knowing that we can do no other than bind ourselves more tightly together and throw ourselves into the holy work of showing up. Some days you can show up, some weeks you can show up, some days you just have to hide in bed with the covers over your head. That's okay. But know that we are here to support you, to help you in that building up, to help you find that clearing space, that clear space where you can build yourself up and go out and do what needs to be done. So what is it that calls you here, that calls you onward, that calls you inward, that calls you homeward? What is it that gives you the power to make that change, to ask that question, to take that journey? What is it that says you have done well? You have done well. That asks you to learn more. That brings you to stillness. What is it that holds you up in hard times? It is relationship. The beating heart of our faith that begins when we share this hour, our truths, share this air, share our hearts. So may it be so. May we make it so. Blessed be. And Amen.